Thank you, John. Appreciate hearing about myself in a row. It's nice to know that I survived life to this point. We have 8 children as well and 12 grandchildren. So when I think about he says all those things, I think, I must have been really bad at all of it, because it's just kind of impossible to think and change diapers and all of that. But I'm not a feminist, don't worry. Feminists don't have 8 children. I do care about women being understood in a way different than they're being understood right now, however. We've had 2 wonderful speakers before tonight in this series. One was a young man from Casper who gave a terrific talk, Kyle Washit, on the civil associations that together make up what I will call the unwritten constitution. And by that I mean that the virtues of a people and the initiatives that people take on their own, from the family through the town to the larger level of the county, all of those associations that you find in those tiers of political and private life make an independent republic work at the higher level. Without those local institutions, without that local involvement, the habit of liberty is lost. And he did a wonderful job of bringing Tocqueville on this point. Then we had our president, who is an historian, Kevin Roberts, speak about the role of the states in American constitutionalism, drawing attention to the federal clamp on the options that states should have constitutionally to be self-ruling, independent with respect to their domestic powers. And he drew attention to the fact that 30% of most state budgets are controlled by federal money, and drew attention to the fact that senators, who are those representatives of each individual state, since the 17th Amendment have been elected directly instead of indirectly, a big mistake. I'll talk about that more a little bit later. But basically what we need to remember, I think, from Professor Roberts' talk is that the states are a double security to our republic, as our founders put it in Federalist 51. And they're a double security because their republics are constitutionally mandated by Article 4, which means they are the place where most government is supposed to happen. And that shift in our perception, maybe not so much in Wyoming, but certainly in the state that I'm from, Illinois, that shift in our perception has been one of the derailing vectors in American history. So tonight I'm going up to the next level, which is the national government. And I would like to retool your perception of the national government, not by talking about simply where it is right now, but by drawing our attention to its roots, its constitutional morality, which I'm going to argue is the Federalist patron. And having taught lawyers, as John mentioned to you, I can attest to the sorry fact that very few lawyers read the Federalist Papers, either on their own, certainly not as part of their schooling, but without reading the Federalist Papers, it's very hard to understand that compact, very lean document called the U.S. Constitution. I'm going to argue that the only way to re-establish that unwritten Constitution, that is, a virtuous people, and the only way to rewrite the proper balance between the state and the nation, and the only way to get the nation to do its constitutional duty in the offices that are held by people that we elect for the most part, the only way to do that is to get away from a rhetoric of envy and class warfare. Now, I want to give you some examples of that in a minute, and you could probably think of a million more. I've had the unhappy duty of reading the newspapers very carefully all summer while I babysat many of my grandchildren in Texas.
And I'm surprised I'm not clinically depressed at this point. But
I know you all keep up with things. But what I want to do tonight is give you hope. I really believe we can't, as my wonderful host, Jim Pecker, said to me tonight, we have to light a candle rather than to curse the darkness. And I'd like to do that by putting in front of our minds and hearts constitutionalism.
We'll look first at what the public good is that our founders aimed at in writing the Constitution in the way they did. And then we'll look at the key central teaching that keeps the passions of the rulers from overwhelming we the people, and that is separation of powers, the most violated part of our Constitution today and for some time.
And then we'll look at the rhetoric of class warfare versus the kind of rhetoric that I think could restore constitutional morality. But first I'm going to start with a few examples that will make you curse the darkness, just to get you as excited as I have been lately about this topic. Because I noticed when I was reading carefully the paper, which I don't always get to do when I'm teaching, because I have my nose in the book that I'm teaching, but I was alarmed by the rhetoric of class warfare, as I'm going to put it. You know, there's a book out by an Englishman who's an MIT graduate. His name is Thomas Piketty. I'm sure you've read reviews of it in the Wall Street Journal or commentary or whatever. But it's called Capital in the 21st Century. And Piketty's book, Jonah Goldberg, who writes in commentary, calls the big book of Marxiness. And when you look at the book and read the reviews about it, what you realize is that his point is being echoed by every other official in the cabinet and in the council of advisors around the president today. And his point is that economic inequality is the major injustice of the 21st century. That the rate of return on capital is greater than growth. And for that reason, we need to redistribute income. Okay? Now, Hillary Clinton's new book says the same thing. The major crisis of our day, she says, is income inequality. It's the few rich, she's not one of them, and the many poor. And what are we going to do about that? Okay.
Secretary of Treasury Jacob Lew, very, very upset about corporate inversion, where those unpatriotic American businessmen take their businesses, whether it's Walgreens, which wants to do this, or Medtronic, or others. They want to go to Ireland. How could they? Which only has a 12% corporate tax, as opposed to staying here with our 35% tax. This is perfectly legal, but President Obama says, I don't care if it's legal, it's wrong. And so he directs Secretary of Treasury Jacob Lew to make it impossible for it to happen by executive mandate.
In addition to these ideas about income inequality, I think there's several other irreconcilable camps that are being fomented in this rhetoric of class warfare. And we know what one of them is, and that is, of course, minorities against the so-called majority, whoever we are anymore. But the minimum wage laws, of course, are supposed to help the underprivileged, right? But in fact, we see that the minimum wage has resulted in a 50% unemployment rate for young black men, whereas before it was 20%. We see that black leaders, like Jason Riley in his book, Please Stop Helping Us, talks about the disadvantage that the programs have done to the black family, to African-American culture, to their whole sense of their own worth as men and women. At the same time, I've lived in Texas for most of my married life. What's happened to the Latino, so-called Latino community is ridiculous. But Richard Rodriguez, one of those men, writes a book in which he says, Hispanics have been the victims, not of the majority, but of the conspiracy of kindness that has become a conspiracy of uncaring. He wanted to get into college based on his merits. not on the fact that he was Hispanic.
So there's backlash even from the very group that we are said to be at war with and that we are told to give our tax funds to for programs that are corrupting them rather than helping them. And then, of course, there's the Affordable Health Care Act. I don't need to say much about that. But as Mortimer Zuckerman puts it, we now have a health care act that results in the full-time scandal of part-time employment because who can afford the term under that Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, when I think of these things which make me bristle, I'm sure you're much calmer than I am. I'm the daughter of a Sicilian from the island.
You know, they had a neat solution for things. There's a lot of
I'm sorry.
It's just being recorded.
When I think about how we should be proceeding rhetorically as we take public office or as we speak on behalf of public officers, I think of a wonderful essay by Robert Goldwyn, who's another academic who thinks about political things, and Goldwyn says, what we should look for in the language in a civil polity is not the language of extreme crisis all the time, okay? Like fire in a theater or stop thief, nor should it be, as he puts it, the soft language of lovers.
But it should be the strong middle language of men engaged in argumentation. How many times do you hear a good argument being made as opposed to the assignation of not being friendly to a certain kind of person or being against other people getting married other than those of the opposite sex?
These are very inflammatory issues, and they're inflammatory because they're not discussed according to principle, because they can't. They don't depend on a principled understanding. Goldwyn goes on to say, you know, the problem is easily explained by looking at the opera Carmen. How about this example? He talks about the gypsy Carmen falling in love with her soldier boy, you know, and he says, love you, baby, but as soon as that bugle bolt blows, I'm out of here. And she goes,
how could you do this to me? Gypsy love knows no law. And he says, well, I know the law, and when I hear the bugle, I'm out of here. And he hears the bugle, and he's gone. And Goldwyn makes this wonderful comment, applying it to, I think, our own day. So it is with unbounded moralism, alluring and seductive, it too knows no law. The morality of our Constitution, however, is very much a bounded and law-abiding morality. You know, what he's talking about, the high moral tone, is taken by those who have no moral grounding for their arguments at all. Right?
What about that guy that owns the Redskins? Hey, what's wrong with him? Doesn't he get it? Isn't he with the flow of history? Change the name of the Redskins. Good Lord, how un-American of it. You see, but there's no argument based on anything that relates to principles, assumptions. So moderation is the virtue that our founders also expounded. When you look at the Federalist Papers, in a minute we'll look at some quotes together. First, I'd like to explain how I'm going to approach, however, this constitutionalism that gives us our morality, our bounded morality, and not just this alluring and seductive moralism.
And that is to explain the word regime,
which as I understood it, hearing it as a child growing up with the threat of the bomb all the time and hiding under my desk and you know, fighting against communism with my parents and so on, I thought regime only meant something bad because it was always the Soviet regime. Right? That's the only time I ever heard the word. I wasn't privy to the real meaning of it until graduate school when I found out regime is Greek for constitution. Regime means constitution. And that's not enough to say that, but regime also
gives us always the answer to the question, who should rule? Right? Because is it us? Monarchy? Is it us? Aristocracy? Is it the rule of the many? Which one is it? And however I answer that question, who should rule, I'm saying, who ought to rule? Who in justice deserves to rule? And they deserve to rule because they merit it. So that gets really complicated. Because we say, who should rule is we the people. I mean, it's obvious to think that a king should rule if he's just and wonderful, but then there's a problem when his son is born and he's rich, or somebody not worthy, right? And it's obvious that the few nobles won't be worthy of rule until they get infatuated with their birth and status and wealth and no longer serve the people. But the choice of we the people is even more complicated than the monarchy or the aristocracy. It demands much more of human beings. Much more. It requires this heroic boast that we can be reflective, deliberate, and choose, again, based on reason. This was the thought of the founders. Justice required, according to our founders, that the genius of the American people be answered with the Republican regime. Now, let me just put that another way. When you make a regime, you have a founder, and we are technically the founders ourselves, although those great minds in Philadelphia, 57 of them in 1987, that we should really thank God for instead. But technically, we were the founders because we decided. Look at that quote on your page, if you don't mind, Federalist One. We decided through reflection and choice whether our society could be chosen based on deliberation or whether we'd be like every other regime and be founded by accident and force. That's more or less what Federalist One says. So the justice of the founder, in our case, the framers and us, requires that we suit the form of the regime and the stock of the people. We wouldn't put up with anything else. The genius, they call it, of the American people in 39 were dedicated to the fundamental principles of the revolution. And to come up with another regime would suit our genius. Now, that doesn't mean that every other people could have this form, but their point was, this is the only form for the people who have inherited English liberties, which in turn were inherited by the Roman Republican tradition. You see, this goes way back. This was also influenced so much by Christendom, by the great contribution of the medievalists, by the thinkers who understood that the vox populi, the voice of the people, is always to be answered to no matter what the form of the regime. That's the great teaching of the medievalists. So our constitutional morality then begins with this assumption that a self-ruling people are going to be moderate enough in their thought, listening to argumentation, not to turn into Athens, okay? The mob, not to be like what's going on in St. Louis right now, not to turn into a mob, or the mob around the time Lincoln in my home state was trying to talk to people in Alton, Illinois, and they were throwing printer presses in the river. No, but we were going to submit ourselves to reverence for the law. They depended on this in the fiber of the American people. So moderation is the key virtue, moderation that is organized around rational discourse about the public good, which I'll get to in a minute. So we need to look at that founding legal document and see how it is glossed or expanded, put it slightly, interpreted by the Federalist Papers as that guide. Because when you read the Constitution, I mean, it's a lean and mean document. Other countries have tried to model the affairs on ours and they just, if they're Latin, they're too verbose, they can't cut it short and say, they're difficulties with other people trying to model. Yeah? They can't get one of the subject matter. Now the people, like we were, are still, we hope. And they don't have that insight into that tradition of liberty
that our people have. So we can't find that each branch is an equal and coordinate branch to the other one. If we read the Constitution, that just wouldn't leap out at us. Okay? We wouldn't know that judicial review is part of the American Constitution.
We wouldn't understand just by reading the Constitution that framers thought very carefully about how to hem in the people's will while letting it have enough expression that you control their passions but let their reasons flourish. So you get representatives for 2 years, and then you can kick them out if you don't like them, right? And they can be pretty young and tough, 25, age of my time. I'm glad he's not a representative.
you can tweak each office so that a different kind of character, a different kind of potential then for serving proper constitutional objects emerges. But you wouldn't know how carefully that was crafted unless you read the federal papers. As Wilmore Kendall, the founder of the particular program that I happen to be in, y'all know Bill Buckley?
He was taught by Wilmore Kendall. Kendall puts it this way. The Federalist Papers give us a way of looking at and interpreting various provisions of the Constitution so as to render it a viable instrument capable of fulfilling the purposes stated in the preamble. So the Federalist Papers are for expostulating what the purposes are in the preamble. So let's,
if you don't mind, look at the preamble together. I love the fact that there are still school children who have to memorize it. And just a comment or two about it before we look at it together is that
there are 33 amendments to the United States Constitution, over 11,000 proposed amendments to the United States Constitution. The preamble has never been touched, never has there been a suggestion or thought to change the preamble. So it's a pretty durable preface to our purposes, to the public good, which is what we're looking at right now.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States. Now, I wish we were in a seminar group like we have at Wyoming Public College so we could just parse this together, but certain things might strike you automatically, and that is there are many ends that people talk about quite regularly as their
due from government, which aren't included here at all. Where is equality? We the people so that we can all be equal in terms of wealth. We the people so that we can all have the right to marry, change our sex, and blah, 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 whenever we want, however we want. Right? We the people who want to have all of our needs filled. Needs, equality, rights, not in here. The emphasis is on justice, on inner peace, external strength so that we can defend ourselves. General welfare is an abused term, not from the preamble, but from the rest of the Constitution. But it generally means the common good. And then, of course, liberty, which is not a given, but a blessing. Ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States, which are already a reality, right? From the time of the Declaration now, for the United States. So we have to measure up, as it were, to the meaning of this preamble, which promises to fulfill its end through the Constitution. Okay, so let's, keeping that in mind, emphasize then that public discourse is this genuine public discourse and not just the harangue of an ideologue, should relate to one of the ends of this preamble. Okay? If it's genuine public discourse, it should be about not who I am, whatever my peculiar features are, right? But about what I said or say.
and about the principles behind that statement.
Seems that Elstein, a wonderful, wonderful political philosopher who died not too long ago,
observes the following. She says, when identity becomes the ground of politics, there is a resultant loss of civility. What matters is not what they say or do, but what they are. Those who disagree with my politics are enemies of my identity.
And when we were up in Jackson, I was impressed by a lady who, you know, heard this point, and she said, gosh, that's happened to me so many times. Well, somebody will come up to me and assume that we have nothing to talk about because I'm against how they live. No. But the fact of the matter is, if you can get people off the ground, which is impossible, we can't have a discussion with somebody whose private identity is the whole point. If you can get them off that ground and think of something that we share in common that relates to one of these ends, then discourse is possible. And I think it's our obligation to do this, not just to say, that idiot, I can't talk to him or her, right? But we have to try to retool people's thoughts in the most civil way possible to hold them accountable to the same document that you and I are, right? That's part of our obligation, it seems to me. There is no politics without friendship. We can't have a politics where there is not friendship. Aristotle says that's the aim of the city.
So let's talk about separation of powers a minute, or two. It's the main teaching that I'd like to remind us of this evening before talking then about the proper rhetoric. On your crib sheet there, there's Federalist 57. Do you see it? Does anybody have copies? Okay. All right. Now this is the clearest statement that I know of in the Federalist Papers where you can get what the philosophy of government is simply, whether it's in China or Great Britain or Africa. This is what our founders think every regime or constitution should possess. Okay? So if you'd be so kind as to look at it with me. The aim of every political constitution, in the first place, to obtain for rulers men who possess most wisdom to discern and most virtue to pursue the common good of the society. And in the next place, to take the most effectual precautions for keeping them virtuous whilst they hold the public trust. Ah, these men knew human nature.
Now, they didn't just have a negative view of nature, as some of the social contract writers did. No, they saw that we were a complex of good and vicious, right? Men are by nature, they say, ambitious, vindictive, rapacious. But if men are not virtuous to be self-ruling, what are we talking about? They want to say, right? There's a portion of goodness, they say, in all mankind. So they're confident in that portion of goodness up to a point. Then you have to put in, as they put it, auxiliary precautions. And the key teaching there is, everyone knows it, who's ever worked in business, who's ever taught children, who's ever raised a family, who's ever done anything. And that is that policy is defined by opposites and rival interests with defects of better motives. You have to get somebody connected with what the person you're entrusting your liberty with. You have to get somebody else looking over his shoulders, sharing the same obligations. You see? And then that somebody that's looking over his shoulder has to get somebody looking over his shoulder. And that's what separation of power says. It blends offices. So the president, when he decides not to enforce the 2009 anti-ballistic missile treaty, not put it up in Poland like you really need right now, right? And decides not to tell the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that there are, in fact, gross violations by Putin of the treaty, the anti-nuclear treaty, doesn't tell the Senate, even John Kerry, the utopian visionary that we have now in Secretary of State, who was so surprised in the 21st century, people still do bad things.
Why aren't we any better? Huh?
We we look at that natural antipathy between the Senate and the presidency when it's working right, when you just don't have rubber stamps in there, right? And the Senate is going to say, wait a minute, that's our turf, and you're not doing your job, Mr. President. You see, that blending of power. I tell the story, I'm sure this is very boring to those of you that have ever been in this situation, but, you know, when I was a newer mother, I used to think you could leave the house and just tell everybody, be good, see you later. Okay? It took me a while to learn that you had to have a Gestapo attitude towards this arrangement, you know? Each person had to have a vested interest in the other person's job. Hello, my children, but they're fallen. You know? So this is an interesting lesson when we read the Federalist Papers, that we know that the very design of the separation of powers responds to the statement in Federalist 51, if men were angels, government would not be necessary. Okay. So you have to control the passions of the many. And that's a separate teaching, which I'm not talking about tonight, but that's solved by the large republic, which is supposed to dissipate our passions. And controlling the passions of the few, that they hold office. Okay? Now, there's more to the separation of powers than just keeping an eye on each other and blending the offices so that the shared constitutional objects act as a kind of check on ambition. Ambition made to counteract ambition. The other part to it is that our founders really expected decent men to go after these offices. Now, you have, I say you, I have to realize that I actually live in the wonderful state of Wyoming. Just bought it, seems like, it's a year ago tonight, so we moved. But you have this wonderful state where you have often pretty good men. You know, I was talking to John on the way up here. Tell me about these candidates. I'm reading the paper about it. And I hear them, and they're just, sometimes there's just a nuance of difference between them. But they're all pretty decent compared to what I've been looking at for most of my voting life. You know, they're pretty decent individuals. And that's what the founders expected. And they had four qualities that they highlighted as attributes of potential candidates. First, that they would be men of duty. So what called them was not the office, but the duty. Okay? Because the anticipation was that there was a sense of service behind the desire for the office. Then they assumed that the men would be noted for their gratitude. And gratitude requires that you measure up to the gift of the office. So it's a rising up, as it were, to what you're being called to, not say, like,
the first word out of Thomas Jefferson's mouth, God bless him, everything is downhill after Washington, but he does. The first thing he says in his first novel is basically, thanks for your vote. Basically, what his first novel begins with. That's not what they mean, gratitude to the vote. But gratitude to the possibility to serve again. And then the other two are, of course, personal interests. Key teaching of Federalists. Again, this is, nobody's blind to this, I'm sure, but it's, we're not utopians. This regime is so practical. It's so wonderfully practical. But that every constitutional object, they say, has to have in it a personal interest for the person holding it. So if you're a House of Representatives member, you're probably a landowner, or, as he says, a merchant, or some sort of manufacturer, or somebody from the landed
someone has a learned profession, so you've got lawyers, landowners, businessmen, basically.
They're going to have an interest to make sure that taxation, which they're also going to have to pay, you know, is just, right? So getting the personal interest connected with the constitutional object. Then he goes on to say, and this is back in the same Federalist paper that you just read the quote from, they can make no law which we will not have its full operation on themselves. The genius of the whole system, the nature of just and constitutional laws, and above all, the vigilant and manly spirit. I love that word, manly, by the way. The Roman word is Andrea. The Greek is thumos. It means spirit. It means spiritedness. You're willing to die for things, right? It's not a sexist term. Women hate whenever you use the word man. Anyway, which nourishes freedom and in return is nourished by it.
And then they conclude, if this spirit shall ever be so far debased as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature as well as on the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. And that's where we are. We have so many exceptions right now for congressmen with respect to the Affordable Health Care Act, exceptions that show that the law is not their law. We will be willing to tolerate anything but liberty. Now, this wonderful teaching of separation of powers, which, you know, we can spend weeks on, was undermined systematically by a series of presidents. First of all, presidents, starting with Teddy Roosevelt, and then clearly continuing with Woodrow Wilson. Wilson saw separation of powers as a drag. You couldn't get things done. And those ignorant congressmen and those benighted American citizens needed experts, right? So he establishes a tremendous bureaucracy, which has only grown, right? And the model, of course, is German bureaucracy. He basically does what Tocqueville says the Americans would never do. And he points in 1832 to America and says, my friend, look at America. Look what they're doing. They have a proper government that's centralized, that has the proper constitutional objectives of that justice and so on. But their administration is decentralized. Everything happens through the organized institution, the closest to the people who need that service. The state and town work. That's what you should do here. We have become administratively special. And this is the great derailment of a Republican liberty.
That kind of thought comes from President Wilson, which was a visionary of things that were impossible, such as lasting peace, and also someone who radically undermined constitutionalism, only to be outdone by President FDR. Now, let's look at that quote. And if I could have one of you gentlemen read for me, perhaps maybe Jim, would you be so kind as to read me that paragraph from FDR's first inaugural? Thank you. So that reminds me of that editorial op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day where Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to our president and the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, wrote an op-ed piece. I think it was the same day as the downing of the Malaysian jet. We had the Boko Haram abduction of the girls still going on. We had the destruction of Nineveh or Mosul going on, the exile of the Christians. It was a very packed, horrible day. Right? And the op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal was by Furman and Jarrett saying that, let me get this right. The Senate had passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act last fall, but it wasn't law yet. It hadn't gone through both houses. So in the absence of legislation, the president took, quote, an important step by using his executive authority to prohibit federal contractors from discriminating based on gender identity in federal employment. They go on. This, along with other bold and lasting comprehensive change, the change you and I were all looking for, stronger and better as a nation now, I'm being ironic, right?
Taking action to prohibit discrimination against LGBT, I'm still quoting workers, is yet another important step. And then they have the temerity to use the language of the preamble, another important step in our march toward a more perfect and prosperous union. Right? That seems to be the most important bit of business on the presidential agenda on that day in our history, where common defense, where what Washington said our calling was in the farewell address, if you remember, was to give an example of exhausted justice and benevolent magnanimity in the world. That was our calling, you know, city on the hill idea. That's the best we can come up with to fulfill a more perfect union. That's not the kind of union I think Washington was talking about. But maybe I'm expecting too much. So what can we do to restore a rhetoric that will pay attention to the public good and the constitutional forms that have been chosen by we the people? Right? Because the choosing has to go on, or it's not going to live. It has to continue to be a choice, and not the kind of choice that's been talked about for the last 4 years. I think we need what President Roberts called, when he was here about a month ago, he called a re-freedom movement. I don't think we can have a re-freedom movement without a re-education movement. And it takes one-on-one, person-to-person. That's why I've been teaching teachers for 35 years. You teach teachers because they didn't really get an education in the founding. Actually, open the shot to despise it. But if you give them the chance to see this beautiful form and how true it is to human nature, something, you know, the veils come off their eyes. It's really quite remarkable. So we need to be in part of that educational movement. And then we need to remember that the rhetoric of the 18th century, though it is eminently gorgeous, can never be our rhetoric. You know, I read these passages, our students pick up the Federalist paper and they go, I've been reading Cicero, and I've been reading all these things in Latin, but this is so much harder, Dr. Arby, than anything I've ever read. You expect us to read 10 Federalist papers tonight? Well, I had to cut it back because, you know, I still have to struggle over these long sentences. But, oh, but marvelous reasoning and thought and argumentation. And the 18th century gentleman was schooled in Cicero, okay? He was a rhetorician, and we teach our students rhetoric at the college. They have to have the tools that our founders had. Quite remarkable. We have two of them in the room. You want to give a speech right now, a little demonstration?
No. Yeah.
Our graduates. But what they did when they spoke to the people, and these Federalist papers were in the newspapers, as you know, was they engaged them, as the historian Gordon Wood put it, in an intimate and trusted relationship. They didn't talk down to their fellow citizens like we're all idiots who can only hear sound bites. Right? They were engaged in grappling in the thought of the policy at hand and whether it matched the constitutional good. So we need to find the men who can find 21st century audiences, captivate them with constitutional morality, right? Policy after policy, and then find those men who are grooming person after person, student after student, in this discourse. Yeah, that's a lot to hope for. But anything good at this point is going to happen small. Unless we become haranguers and ideologues, unless we turn violent, okay, anything that we can do, if it's based on rational discourse, has to be small and excellent. And we'll have to be patient, right?
Okay. We'll have to be patient. One thing we must do is insist that the identity politics language, or the language that says you're not with the flow of history, right? History has now become God, you know, whatever the flow of history means, or you're out of it, right? That kind of thinking, or that doesn't conform to the polls. That's not what the American people are thinking. We have to call that kind of argumentation non-argumentation. It comes out of an ideologue who is shameless, who thinks of himself or herself as defining reality just because they have a certain desire or moralism that's alluring and seductive to them. So we have to insist on the right grounds for the conversation. And then it seems to me what we have to do is restore a sense of shame. You know, in the wonderful dialogue by Plato called the Pythagoras, there's this myth, and Zeus has made men, and he thinks everything's fine, and they should be happy down there, and then he sees them all killing each other. And he says to Hermes, his messenger god, I think I left something out in the human soul. Go back down there and put shame in. Because without shame, obedience to the law is not possible. We need to put back, as Hannah Arendt put it, the boundaries of shame. We need to veil over the private. I don't care about certain preferences, okay? We need to veil those things. They need to be hidden. Because shame gives a reluctance, as Peter Farnhofer puts it, recognition of our fallen state. It's not virtue, but at least it recognizes our fallen state. You can do something with shame. You can't do anything with an ideologue who doesn't have shame. It's a recognition of our incompleteness. It would make it possible for us, again, to move from this kind of incommensurable discussion that people have, you know. People are talking at each other, but they're not talking to each other. We have to restore the grounds of argumentation and tell somebody, if they're haranguing you for not being with it or not being with the flow of history, that the problem isn't that you're not with the flow of history, but that they don't have a good forensic to embody their thought. They have no way of conveying it, because they don't share the common thought. T.S. Eliot, the poet, George Will quotes today in a little piece I noticed in the paper that success is relative, he says. It is what we make of the mess we have made of things. And my view is that, you know, you can't clean it all up at once, but you can start one-on-one in conversation. The right rhetoric is embodied, it seems to me, in the preamble, where we have to, like it, before the restoration of the civil conversation, as the preamble was for the United States of America. And we can only do this with gratitude ourselves. Okay? Our focus should be, let's be grateful for what we've been given, share that gratitude very positively and intelligently, and then invite others to measure up to the high standards of political participation. That's a labor. That's the real work. I mean, if you're like me, I sometimes just want to go, off with your head. But we can't do that, right? We have the obligation through that labor of gratitude to participate once again in the epic founding of America, to answer whether it's possible for men to choose their political constitutions based on reflection and choice, or will we forever be vulnerable to accident and force? And if we don't restore this conversation to constitutional morality, what we're going to have is arbitrary rules outside the rule of law. Arbitrary rule is always anarchy, and he always looks for a solution. And it will be the demagogue who will foment that rhetoric of inflammation and division that will cause our ruin. So change the rhetoric, change the recommitment to education, restore constitutional morality. Thank you.